Remembering Connecticut, the Knights of Labor. In the 1870s and 80s, an argument raged over who would control the new wealth generated by industry and how the evolving industrial society would be organized. Workers had numerous complaints, but to many, the big corporations threatened more than wages and working conditions. They threatened the very fabric of democracy. As one Connecticut minister put it,
"The corporations are establishing a lawless and moneyed aristocracy on the ruins of one free America."
In response, working people formed trade unions which acted on behalf of the workers in a single craft. The Knights of Labor, a group formed in Philadelphia in 1869, took a broad approach and sought to reform the overall relationship between industry and the rest of society. The Knights originally had a code of secrecy and arcane rituals, not unlike a fraternal organization. But their statement of principles held wide appeal.
"To secure to the workers the full enjoyment of the wealth they create, sufficient leisure in which to develop their intellectual, moral, and social faculties. In a word, to enable them to share in the gains and honor of advancing civilization."
Once the veil of secrecy had been lifted in 1879, membership multiplied. Soon after, the Connecticut Knights included almost 200 local assemblies and some 10,000 members who took political advantage of their growing numbers. In 1884, the New Haven Register reported on the state Democratic Convention.
"The majority of the delegates are Knights of Labor. They worked hard at the primaries for these delegates, and by common consent were allowed to have things about as they wished."
The legislature, elected the following fall, included 37 members of the Knights and went on to pass Connecticut's first effective laws barring child labor. Also instituted was a law requiring prompt payment of wages to free workers from a cycle of debt, and a law establishing the safety inspection of workplaces. Despite these victories, the Knights faced collapse at the moment of their greatest success. The group's leadership saw as their goal broad social and economic change. To that end, they offered membership to all workers, skilled and unskilled, male and female, and people of every race and ethnic group. Many workers, however, joined the Knights to gain support for their specific grievances. And from the start, the Knights were hampered by this internal tension. At one meeting of District Assembly 95, the state leader, Thomas Kehoe, questioned an angry member,
"You say you have had this grievance existing for years, but what did you do about it before you joined the Knights of Labor?"
"We had to grin and bear it. But what is this great order of the Knights of Labor good for if we cannot have our grievance righted?"
In the attempt to address localized issues, the Knights of Labor were drawn into several bitter, unsuccessful strikes. Failures cost them credibility and diverted money and energy away from their successful political strategy. To provide a forum for single plant issues, the Knights authorized the formation of trade assemblies for single crafts, a departure from their previous policy. But these were a pale imitation of the unions then forming under the American Federation of Labor, and the Knights accelerated their own decline by endorsing this system. Some assemblies lived on as AFL locals, but the Knights as a whole were moribund by the early 1890s. However, long after the organization was forgotten, positions it had espoused continued to have impact. Article 22 of the Knights Constitution articulated a goal that is as current as tomorrow's news: to secure for both sexes equal rights. Furthermore, binding arbitration, regulation of the securities market, and a graduated income tax all went on to become law.